I'm sorry, she said. You've been very kind to me. I won't repay your kindness with what would be a very common story. She rose to go, and I rose with her. I'm not a bad listener, I said, and I have some time. My next patient cancelled. No, she said. Thank you, but no. All right, I said, but there is something else. Yes? It's not my policy to make my patients, any of my patients, pay for services in advance of those services being rendered. I hope if you... That is, if you feel you'd like to, or have to... I fumbled my way into silence. I've been in New York 4 years, Dr. McCarran, and I'm thrifty by nature. After August or September, I'll have to live on what's in my savings account until I can go back to work again. It's not a great amount, and sometimes during the nights mostly I become frightened. She looked at me steadily with those wonderful hazel eyes. It seemed better to me, safer, to pay for the baby first, ahead of everything, because that is where the baby is in my thoughts, and because later on the temptation to spend that money might become very great. All right, I said. But please remember that I see it as having been paid before accounts. If you need it, say so. And bring out the dragon and Mrs. Davidson again? The impish light was back in her eyes. I don't think so. And now, Doctor, you intend to work as long as possible. Absolutely as long as possible. Yes, I have to. Why? I think I'm going to frighten you a little before you go, I said. Her eyes widened slightly. Don't do that, she said. I'm frightened enough already. Which is exactly why I'm going to do it. Sit down again, Miss Stansfield. And when she only stood there, I added, please. She sat, reluctantly. You are in a unique and unenviable position, I told her, sitting on the corner of my desk. You are dealing with the situation with remarkable grace. She began to speak, and I held up my hand to silence her. That's good. I salute you for it. But I would hate to see you hurt your baby in any way out of concern for your own financial security. I had a patient who, in spite of my strenuous advice to the contrary, continued packing herself into a girdle month after month, strapping it tighter and tighter as her pregnancy progressed. She was a vain, stupid, tiresome woman, and I don't believe she really wanted the baby anyway. I don't subscribe to many of these theories of the subconscious which everyone seems to discuss over their mahjong boards these days, but if I did, I would say that she or some part of her was trying to kill the baby. And did she? Her face was very still. No, not at all. But the baby was born retarded. It's very possible that the baby would have been retarded anyway, and I'm not saying otherwise. We know next to nothing about what causes such things, but she may have caused it. I take your point, she said in a low voice. You don't want me to pack myself in so I can work another month or 6 weeks. I'll admit the thought had crossed my mind, so thank you for the fright. This time I walked her to the door. I would have liked to ask her just how much or how little she had left in that savings book, and just how close to the edge she was. It was a question she would not answer. I knew that well enough. So I merely bade her goodbye and made a joke about her vitamins. She left. I found myself thinking about her at odd moments over the next month, and... Johansson interrupted McCarran's story at this point. They were old friends, and I suppose that gave him the right to ask the question that had surely crossed all our minds. Did you love her, Emlyn? Is that what all this is about, this stuff about her eyes and smile and how you thought of her at odd moments? I thought that McCarran might be annoyed at this interruption, but he was not. You have a right to ask the question, he said, and paused, looking into the fire. It seemed that he might almost have fallen into a doze. Then a dry knot of wood exploded, sending sparks up the chimney in a swirl, and McCarran looked around, first at Johansson and then at the rest of us. No, I didn't love her. The things I've said about her sound like the things a man who was falling in love would notice, her eyes, her dresses, her laugh. He lit his pipe with a special bolt-like pipe lighter that he carried, drawing the flame until there was a bed of coals there. Then he snapped the bolt shut, dropped it into the pocket of his jacket, and blew out a plume of smoke that shifted slowly around his head in an aromatic membrane. I admired her. That was the long and short of it, and my admiration grew with each of her visits. I suppose some of you sense this as a story of love crossed by circumstance. Nothing could be further from the truth. Her story came out a bit at a time over the next half year or so, and when you gentlemen hear it, I think you'll agree that it was every bit as common as she herself said it was. She had been drawn to the city like a thousand other girls. She had come from a small town in Iowa or Nebraska, or possibly it was Minnesota, I don't really remember anymore. She had done a lot of high school dramatics, act as well. It can change the way one looks at the world, the faces one sees in the street look not just indifferent but ugly, perhaps even malignant. Homesickness is a real sickness, the ache of the uprooted plant. Miss Stansfield, admirable as she may have been, determined as she may have been, was not immune to it. And the rest follows so naturally it needs no telling. There was a young man in her acting classes. The two of them went out several times. She did not love him, but she needed a friend. By the time she discovered he was not that and never would be, there had been two incidents. Sexual incidents. She discovered she was pregnant. She told the young man, who told her he would stand by her and do the decent thing. A week later, he was gone from his lodgings, leaving no forwarding address. That was when she came to me. During her fourth month, I introduced Miss Stansfield to the breathing method, what is today called the Lamaze method. In those days, you understand, Monsieur Lamaze was yet to be heard from. In those days, the phrase has cropped up again and again, I notice. I apologize for it, but I am unable to help it. So much of what I have told you and will tell you happened as it did because it happened in those days. So, in those days, 45 years ago, a visit to the delivery rooms in any large American hospital would have sounded to you like a visit to a madhouse. Women weeping wildly, women screaming that they wished they were dead, women screaming that they could not bear such agony, women screaming for Christ to forgive them their sins, women screaming out strings of curses and gutter words their husbands and fathers never would have believed they knew. All of this quite the accepted thing, in spite of the fact that most of the world's women give birth in almost complete silence, aside from the grunting sounds of strain that we would associate with any piece of hard physical labor. Doctors were responsible for some of this hysteria, I'm sorry to say. The stories the pregnant women heard from friends and relatives who had already been through the birthing process also contributed to it. Believe me, if you are told that some experience is going to hurt, it will hurt. Most pain is in the mind, and when a woman absorbs the idea that the act of giving birth is excruciatingly painful, when she gets this information from her mother, her sisters, her married friends, and her physician, that woman has been mentally prepared to feel great agony. Even after only 6 years' practice, I had become used to seeing women who were trying to cope with a twofold problem. Not just the fact that they were pregnant and must plan for the newer idea of the breathing method. Screaming wastes energy, which would be better used to expel the baby. It causes the woman to hyperventilate, and hyperventilation puts the body on an emergency basis. Adrenals running full blast, respiration and pulse rate up. That is really unnecessary. The breathing method was supposed to help the mother focus her attention on the job at hand and to cope with pain by utilizing the body's own resources. It was used widely at that time in India and Africa. In America, the Shoshone, Kiowa, and Mi'kmaq Indians all used it. The Eskimos have always used it. But, as you may guess, most Western doctors had little interest in it. One of my colleagues, an intelligent man, returned the typescript of my pregnancy pamphlet to me in the fall of 1931 with a red line drawn through the entire section on the breathing method. In the margin, he had scribbled that if he wanted to know about nigger superstitions, he would stop by a newsstand and buy an issue of Weird Tales. Well, I didn't cut the section from the pamphlet, as he had suggested, but I had mixed results with the method. That was the best one could say. There were women who used it with great success. There were others who seemed to grasp the idea perfectly in principle, but who lost their discipline completely as soon as their contractions became deep and heavy. In most of those cases, I found that the entire idea had been subverted and undermined by well-meaning friends and relatives who had never heard of such a thing and thus could not believe it would actually work. The method was based on the idea that While no two labors are ever the same in specifics, all are pretty much alike in general. There are four stages: contractive labor, mid-labor, birth, and the expulsion of the afterbirth. Contractions are a complete hardening of the abdominal and pelvic area muscles, and the expectant mother often finds them beginning in the sixth month. Many women pregnant for the first time expect something rather nasty, like bowel cramps, but I'm told it's much cleaner, a strongly physical sensation which may deepen into a pain like a Charlie horse. A woman employing the breathing method began to breathe in a series of short, measured inhales and exhales when she felt a contraction coming on. Each breath was expelled in a puff, as if one were blowing a trumpet Dizzy Gillespie fashion. During mid-labor, when more painful contractions begin coming every 15 minutes or so, the woman switched to long inhales followed by long exhales. It's the way a marathon runner breathes when he's starting his final kick. The harder the contraction, the longer the inhale-exhale. In my pamphlet, I call this stage riding the waves. The final stage we need concern ourselves with here I called locomotive, and Lamar's instructors today frequently call it the choo-choo stage of breathing. Final labor is accompanied by pains which are most frequently described as deep and glassy. They are accompanied by an irresistible urge on the mother's part to push, to expel the baby. This is the point, gentlemen, at which that wonderful, frightening engine reaches its absolute crescendo. The cervix is fully dilated, the baby has begun its short journey down the birth canal, and if you were to look directly between the mother's legs, you would be apt to see the baby's fontanelle pulsing only inches from the open air. The mother, using the breathing method now, begins to take and let out short, sharp breaths between her lips, not filling her lungs, not hyperventilating, but almost panting in a perfectly controlled fashion. It really is the sound children make when they are imitating a steam-driven locomotive. All of this has a salutary effect on the body. The mother's oxygen is kept high without putting her systems on an emergency basis, and she herself remains aware and alert, able to ask and answer questions, able to take instructions. But, of course, the mental results of the breathing method were even more important. The mother felt she was actively participating in the birth of her child, that she was in some part guiding the process. She felt on top of the experience, and on top of the pain. You can understand that the whole process was utterly dependent on the patient's state of mind. The breathing method was uniquely vulnerable, uniquely delicate. And if I had a good many failures, I'd explain them this way. What a patient can be convinced of by her doctor, she may be unconvinced of by relatives who raise their hands in horror when told of such a heathenish practice. From this aspect, at least, Miss Stansfield was the ideal patient. She had neither friends nor relatives to talk her out of her belief in the breathing method, although in all fairness I must add that I doubt anyone ever talked her out of anything once she made up her mind on the subject, once she came to believe in it. And she did come to believe in it. "It's a little like self-hypnosis, isn't it?" she asked me the first time we really discussed it. I agreed, delighted. "Exactly. But you mustn't let that make you think it's a trick, or that it will let you down when the going gets tough." "I don't think that at all. I'm very grateful to you. I'll practice assiduously, Dr. McCarran." She was the sort of woman the breathing method was invented for. And when she told me she would practice, she spoke nothing but the truth. I have never seen anyone embrace an idea with such enthusiasm. But, of course, the breathing method was uniquely suited to her temperament. There are docile men and women in this world by the millions, and some of them are damn fine people. But there are others whose hands ache to hold the throttles of their own lives, and Miss Stansfield was one of those. When I say she embraced the breathing method totally, I mean it, and I think the story of her final day at the department store where she sold perfumes and cosmetics proves the point. The end of her gainful employment finally came late in August. Miss Stansfield was a slim young woman in fine physical condition, and this was, of course, her first child. Any doctor will tell you that such a woman is apt not to show for 5, perhaps even 6 months. And then, one day and all at once, everything will show. She came in for her monthly checkup on the 1st of September, laughed ruefully, and told me she had discovered the breathing method had another use. "What's that?" I asked her. It's even better than counting to 10 when you're mad as hell at someone, she said. Those hazel eyes were dancing. Although people look at you as if you might be a lunatic when you start puffing and blowing. She told me the tale readily enough. She had gone to work as usual on the previous Monday, and all I can think is that the curiously abrupt transition from a slim young woman to an obviously pregnant young woman, and that transition really can be almost as sudden as day to dark in the tropics, had happened to her over the weekend. Or maybe her supervisor finally decided that her suspicions were no longer just suspicions. "I'll want to see you in the office on your break," this woman, a Mrs. Kelly, said coldly. She had previously been quite friendly to Miss Stansfield. She had shown her pictures of her two children, both in high school, and they had exchanged recipes at one point. Mrs. Kelly was always asking her if she had met a nice boy yet. That kindliness and friendliness was gone now, and when she stepped into Mrs. Kelly's office on her break, Miss Stansfield told me she knew what to expect. "You're in trouble," this previously kind woman said curtly. "Yes," Miss Stansfield said. "It's called that by some people." Mrs. Kelly's cheeks had gone the color of old brick. "Don't you be smart with me, young woman," she said. "From the looks of your belly, you've been too smart by half already." I could see the two of them in my mind's eye as she told me the story. Miss Stansfield, her direct hazel eyes fixed on Mrs. Kelly, perfectly composed, refusing to drop her eyes or weep or exhibit shame in any other way. I believe she had a much more practical conception of the trouble she was in than her supervisor did, with her two almost grown children and her respectable husband who owned his own barbershop and voted Republican. "I must say you show remarkably little shame at the way you've deceived me," Mrs. Kelly burst out bitterly. "I have never deceived you. No mention of my pregnancy has been made until today." She looked at Mrs. Kelly curiously. "How can you say I have deceived you?" "I took you home," Mrs. Kelly cried. "I had you to dinner with my sons." She looked at Miss Stansfield with utter loathing. This is when Miss Stansfield began to grow angry. Angrier, she told me, than she had ever been in her life. She had not been unaware of the sort of reaction she could expect when the secret came out. But as any one of you gentlemen will attest, the difference between academic theory and practical application can sometimes be shockingly huge. Clutching her hands firmly together in her lap, Miss Stansfield said, "If you are suggesting I made or ever would make any attempt to seduce your sons, that's the dirtiest, filthiest thing I've ever heard in my life." Mrs. Kelly's head rocked back as if she had been slapped. That bricky color drained from her cheeks, leaving only two small spots of hectic color. The two women looked grimly at each other across a desk littered with perfume samples in a room that smelled vaguely of flowers. It was a moment, Miss Stansfield said, that seemed much longer than it actually could have been. Then Mrs. Kelly yanked open one of her drawers and brought out a buff-colored check. A bright pink severance slip was attached to it. Showing her teeth, actually seeming to bite off each word, she said, "With hundreds of decent girls looking for work in this city, I hardly think we need a strumpet such as yourself in our employ, dear." She told me it was that final contemptuous "dear" that brought all her anger to a sudden head. A moment later, Mrs. Kelly's jaw dropped and her eyes widened as Miss Stansfield, her hands locked together as tightly as links in a steel chain, so tightly she left bruises on herself, they were fading but still perfectly visible when I saw her on September 1st, began to locomotive between her clenched teeth. It wasn't a funny story, perhaps, but I burst out laughing at the image, and Miss Stansfield joined me. Mrs. Davidson looked in to make sure we hadn't gotten into the nitrous oxide, perhaps, and then left again. "It was all I could think to do," Miss Stansfield said, still laughing and wiping her streaming eyes with her handkerchief, "because at that moment I saw myself reaching out and simply sweeping those sample bottles of perfume, every one of them, off her desk and onto the floor, which was uncarpeted concrete. I didn't just think it, I saw it. I saw them crashing to the floor and filling the room with such a god-awful mixed stench that the fumigators would have to come. I was going to do it. Nothing was going to stop me doing it. Then I began to locomotive and everything was all right. I was able to take the check and the pink slip and get up and get out. I wasn't able to thank her, of course. I was still being a locomotive." We laughed again, and then she sobered. "It's all passed off now. and I am even able to feel a little sorry for her. Or does that sound like a terribly stiff-necked thing to say?
Not at all. I think it's an admirable way to be able to feel.
May I show you something I bought with my severance pay, Dr. McCarran?
Yes, if you like.
She opened her purse and took out a small, flat box. I bought it at a pawn shop, she said, for $2, and it's the only time during this whole nightmare that I felt ashamed and dirty. Isn't that strange? She opened the box and laid it on my desk so I could look inside. I wasn't surprised at what I saw. It was a plain gold wedding ring. I'll do what's necessary, she said. I am staying in what Mrs. Kelly would undoubtedly call a respectable boarding house. My landlady has been kind and friendly in her eyes again. As I watched, one of them overspilled and rolled down her cheek. Please, I said, distressed, and reached across the desk to take her hand. It was very, very cold. Don't, my dear. She turned her hand, it was the left, over in my hand, and looked at the ring. She smiled, and that smile was as bitter as gall and vinegar, gentlemen. Another tear fell, just that one. When I hear cynics say that the days of magic and miracles are all behind us, Dr. McCarran, I'll know they're deluded, won't I? When you can buy a ring in a pawn shop for $2, and that ring will instantly erase both bastardy and licentiousness, what else could you call that but magic? Cheap magic. Miss Stansfield. Sandra, if I may, if you need help, if there's anything I can do... She drew her hand away from me. If I had taken her right hand instead of her left, perhaps she would not have done. I did not love her, I've told you, but in that moment I could have loved her. I was on the verge of falling in love with her. Perhaps if I'd taken her right hand instead of the one with that lying ring on it, and if she had allowed me to hold her hand only a little longer until my own warmed it, perhaps then I should have. You're a good, kind man, and you've done a great deal for me and my baby, and your breathing method is a much better kind of magic than this awful ring. After all, it kept me from being jailed on charges of willful destruction, didn't it? She left soon after that, and I went to the window to watch her move off down the street toward Fifth Avenue. God, I admired her just then. She looked so slight, so young, and so obviously pregnant, but there was still nothing timid or tentative about her. She did not scutter up the street. She walked as if she had every right to her place on the sidewalk. She left my view, and I turned back to my desk. As I did so, the framed photograph which hung on the wall next to my diploma caught my eye, and a terrible shudder worked through me. My skin, all of it, even the skin on my forehead and the backs of my hands, crawled up into cold knots of goose flesh. The most suffocating fear of my entire life fell on me like a horrible shroud, and I found myself gasping for breath. It was a precognitive interlude, gentlemen. I do not take part in arguments about whether or not such things can occur. I know they can, because it has happened to me. Just that once, on that hot early September afternoon, I pray to God I never have another. The photograph had been taken by my mother on the day I finished medical school. It showed me standing in front of White Memorial, hands behind my back, grinning like a kid who's just gotten a full day pass to the rides at Palisades Park. To my left, the statue of Harriet White can be seen, and although the photograph cuts her off at about mid-shin, the pedestal and that queerly heartless inscription, "There is no comfort without pain, thus we define salvation through suffering," could be clearly seen. It was at the foot of the statue of my father's first wife, directly below that inscription, that Sandra Stansfield died not quite 4 months later in a senseless accident that occurred just as she arrived at the hospital to deliver her child. She exhibited some anxiety that fall that I would not be there to attend her during labor, that I would be away for the Christmas holidays or not on call. She was partly afraid that she would be delivered by some doctor who would ignore her wish to use the breathing method and who would instead give her gas or a spinal block. I assured her as best I could. I had no reason to leave the city, no family to visit over the holidays. My mother had died 2 years before, and there was no one else except a maiden aunt in California, and the train didn't agree with me, I told Miss Stansfield. Are you ever lonely? She asked. Sometimes. Usually I keep too busy. Now, take this. I jotted my home telephone number on a card and gave it to her. If you get the answering service when your labor begins, call me here. Oh, no, I couldn't. Do you want to use the breathing method, or do you want to get some sawbones who'll think you're mad and give you a capful of ether as soon as you start to locomotive? She smiled a little. All right, I'm convinced. But as the autumn progressed and the butchers on Third Avenue began advertising the per-pound price of their young and succulent toms, it became clear that her mind was still not at rest. She had indeed been asked to leave the place where she had been living when I first met her and had moved to the village, but that at least had turned out quite well for her. She had even found work of a sort. A blind woman with a fairly comfortable income had hired her to do some light housework and then to read to her from the works of Jean Stratton Porter and Pearl Buck. She lived on the first floor of Miss Stansfield that day, and how large her belly seemed. I know about that, she said. I felt it, but it's quite separate from this other feeling. This other feeling is like something looming up. I can't describe it any better than that. It's silly, but I can't shake it. You must try, I said. It isn't good for the... But she had drifted away from me. She was looking at the photograph again. Who is that? Emlyn McCarran, I said, trying to make a joke. It sounded extraordinarily feeble. Back before the Civil War, when he was quite young. No, I recognized you, of course, she said. The woman. You can only tell it is a woman from the hem of the skirt and the shoes. Who is she? Her name is Harriet White, I said, and thought, and hers will be the first face you see when you arrive to deliver your child. The chill came back, that dreadful, drifting, formless chill. Her stone face. And what does it say there at the base of the statue? She asked, her eyes still dreamy, almost trance-like. I don't know, I lied. My conversational Latin is not that good. That night I had the worst dream of my entire life. I woke up from it in utter terror, and if I had been married, I suppose I would have frightened my friends about the brave young widow who, in spite of her recent bereavement and delicate condition, was facing her own future with such determined good cheer. Several of the blind woman's friends had expressed an interest in employing her following the birth of her child. I'll take them up on it, too, she told me, for the baby. But only until I'm on my feet again and able to find something steady. Sometimes I think the worst part of this, of everything that's happened, is that it's changed the way I look at people. Sometimes I think to myself, how can you sleep at night, knowing that you've deceived that dear old thing? And then I think, if she knew, she'd show you the door, just like all the others. Either way, it's a lie, and I feel the weight of it on my heart sometimes. Before she left that day, she took a small, gaily wrapped package from her purse and slid it shyly across the desk to me. Merry Christmas, Dr. McCarran. You shouldn't have, I said, sliding open a drawer and taking out a package of my own. But since I did, too... She looked at me for a moment, surprised, and then we laughed together. She had gotten me a silver tie clasp with a caduceus on it. I had gotten her an album in which to keep photographs of her baby. I still have the tie clasp. Cab leaped forward, wheels spinning over the ice with little or no traction. I had walked to the hospital, and my arrival coincided with the cab's arrival only because I had underestimated just how bad driving conditions had become. I believed I would find her upstairs, a legally admitted patient, with all her papers signed, her prep completed, working her way steadily through her mid-labor. I was mounting the steps when I saw the sudden sharp convergence of two sets of headlights reflected from the patch of ice where the janitors hadn't yet spread cinders. I turned, just in time, to see it happen. An ambulance was nosing its way out of the emergency wing rampway as Miss Stansfield's cab came toward the hospital. The cab was simply going too fast to stop. The cabbie panicked and stamped down on the brake pedal rather than pumping it. The cab slid, then began to turn broadside. The pulsing dome light of the ambulance threw moving stripes and blotches of blood-colored light over the scene, and freakishly one of these illuminated the face of Sandra Stansfield. For that one moment it was the face in my dream, the same bloody, open-eyed face that I had seen on her severed head. I cried out her name, took two steps down, slipped and fell, sprawling. I cracked my elbow, a paralyzed through the rear right-side window of the dismembered cab like a rag doll.
End of side 3.